It's religion today, it's ideology today, and our secularist friends also have a faith.
Some kind of Disneyland fantasy.
I know how this is going to get heard in the secular world.
Where the pseudo-Christian masks are off.
That's nonsense, ladies and gentlemen.
Apologetics isn't just about giving answers to other people's questions. It's also about learning to question other people's answers or even question the question itself.
In a Christian worldview.
Welcome to Quantum Number 9. Well, last week we had a look at Jose Mourinho, the, shall we say, less than humble football manager. This week we mention another sports person. It should be Naomi Osaka, who actually won the US Open.
Game, second match, Osaka, 6-2, 6-4.
However, it's Serena Williams, her defeated opponent, who's taken all the headlines because of her temper tantrum. Her coach was accused of coaching, and she had a verbal assault upon the umpire. And since then, she's accused him of being misogynistic and racist and everything else. She said she's fighting for women's rights and for equalities. Well, I could just as easily accuse her of being racist because Carlos Ramos, the umpire, is Latino. Her big problem, of course, is that her coach has actually admitted to coaching, which is illegal in tennis when the game is on. Another aspect of this is that there was a cartoon published in Australia, which has again also been accused of being racist. Now, here's the problem with cartoons. By definition, they exaggerate people's features. I just wonder if there is any cartoon of any black person or Chinese person which would not consider to be racist in some way or other. And again, I think Serena Williams' temper and the reaction to it by people such as J.K. Rowling, who are very supportive of her, I think it's quite depressing and indicative of the state our culture is in. On the other hand, it's not all bad.
Splendid ovation for Alistair Cook as he walks out to the crease for the 291st and final time.
Alistair Cook, the English cricket captain, retired, and retired in remarkable fashion. His very last innings against India, he scored a century, he received a standing ovation. He actually looked embarrassed. He comes across as quite humble. When I pointed this out in a tweet, somebody immediately replied, yes, but he's white and middle class. And I just wanted to bang my head against the desk and just give up. Why is everything defined by race and gender and identity? We don't just have identity politics now, we have identity sport. Now, speaking of identity, let's turn to South Yorkshire Police, who tweeted this week, in addition to reporting hate crime, please report non-crime hate incidents, which can include things like offensive or insulting comments, online, in person or in writing. Hate will not be tolerated in South Yorkshire. Report it and put a stop to it. Stop and think about that. Police are there to deal with crime, are they not? Well, here the police are now saying, we're not just dealing with crime, we're dealing with hatred, all kinds of hatred. Well, except it's not all kinds of hatred. We know exactly what they're talking about.
Because we're talking about people in our communities who may be disabled, people who may have issues about their gender identity, which other people take exception to. They may be people of a particular faith, they may be people of a particular race, and that can be of any race, and it can go any which way.
They are now saying they're there to police our emotions and police our thoughts. This is South Yorkshire Police, who made such a mess at the Hillsborough disaster, who were often responsible for incidents like the Rotherham abuse and their failure to actually deal with it.
Do you not think that there will be an awful lot of people in the South Yorkshire area, your communities that you speak so much about, who might prefer it if the police spent their time investigating gang rape of teenage girls rather than people whose feelings are hurt on Twitter?
If it's a case of either or, then of course that would be absolutely.
It is a case of either or. You don't investigate all the crimes that are committed. Do you not think that once you've sorted out the actual crimes, maybe you might have time to deal with some of the non-crimes?
No, because I think these are things that are affecting the police in policing on a daily basis.
What do they mean, hate crime or offensive or insulting comments? I get loads of tweets that are offensive or insulting. Things that I say to some people are offensive or insulting. Some of the things on this podcast will be offensive or insulting. What the South Yorkshire Police are doing, it's Orwellian 1984, as Julia Hartley Bluer pointed out.
So the stuff that's criminal, you may or may not want to investigate. The stuff that's not criminal, none of your business. Freedom of speech in this country. As long as someone's inciting violence or threatening violence, they have a right to express their opinion in this country, last time I looked.
People have a total right to express their opinion.
Except if you don't like it.
If the expression of that opinion leads them into a non-crime incident, which may well develop into a criminal incident.
How does someone sending a tweet that hurts someone's feelings, it may be a tweet that you would never write, it may be a tweet that I would never write, it may be a tweet that I read and think, oh, they sound like a nasty piece of work. If it's not a crime, it's none of your business.
Well, it's all right for us to sit in our radio studios or in our offices saying this, but if you live in some of these communities where people are deeply affected by this and that causes tension within our communities, that becomes an issue for policing.
I guess this next piece, South Yorkshire Police will call hate crime, because it's just so incredible.
What are the rules for dealing with the growing numbers of transgender prisoners? The prison service has had to apologise after a trans woman inmate who'd been transferred from a male to a female prison went on to commit several sexual assaults within days of arriving. 52-year-old Karen White was a convicted paedophile, born Stephen Wood. She was undergoing gender reassignment but had not undergone full surgery when accused of raping a woman in 2016. She was sent to the women-only jail, Newhall, in West Yorkshire, but since pleading guilty to indecently assaulting two of the prisoners there, she's been transferred to an all-male prison.
Here's an amazing story, and I just think about how do I explain this to so many people who must be thoroughly confused at what's going on in our culture. A man who was convicted of a severe rape, said that he felt like a woman, that he was a woman. And so instead of going to a male prison, he went to a female prison, where he has committed another 4 attacks on women. So get this, in our culture today, our authorities think it's okay to send a male rapist to a female prison purely and simply on his own say-so that he thinks he is a woman.
Dr. Nicola Williams from the campaign group Fair Play for Women says that the risk assessment procedure within the prison system is far from adequate.
I'm concerned about the prison rules that allow this to happen, really. The rules say that any male prisoner can request transfer into the female prison if he considers his gender identity to be female. Now, that doesn't mean he has to have gender surgery or even be on any medication. It can be simply a self-declaration that that person feels female. Now, in that case, the request must be assessed by a transgender case board, and then they have the discretion to transfer that prisoner into a female prison. So it's the rules that need to be looked at here. The rules facilitated this transfer of basically a rapist into a women's prison.
That is what apparently the rule says. Any prisoner can request a transfer to a women's prison if they feel that they are a woman. Do you know, I think of it in this way. Supposing someone came to my church and said, I've been convicted of paedophilia. And I said to them, do you know this? You feel like a Sunday school teacher. We're going to put you in charge of the Sunday school. We would be sued to nonsense. And yet such is the fear of the transgender lobby that the government and officials think they can go along with this. So here we have this crazy world in which the police are saying to people, if someone says they hate you or if they say something that you find offensive, get in touch with us, even if it's not a crime. And yet our state authorities are putting a male rapist into a women's prison. Our friend Oz Guinness talks about the decline of civilized discourse and the need for us to be able to have that. I totally agree. This incident with Jacob Rees-Mogg indicates why that is necessary.
You won't answer, will you? Your dad won't answer the question. Your daddy's a totally horrible person.
Darling, go in, don't talk
to us. Lots of people don't like your daddy, you know that. No, he's probably not told you about that. Anyway, lots of people hate him. Because he won't say how much he pays his... You know the nanny he looks after? Daddy doesn't pay her very much. Daddy says the minimum wage doesn't count for anything. All the London living wage.
The trouble is that in the world of social media, it is so much easier to stir up a mob. And when I see politicians continually retweeting things that serve only to create hatred or just to confirm their own bias, to show that everyone else is evil but they themselves are good, then it's little wonder that these kinds of incidents occur. I think we as Christians need to be really careful as well how we behave. We need to learn to be able to disagree with people without indulging in abuse. But if you want an example, another example of hate speech and the madness to which people go and how they reinterpret history just to suit their own current worldview, then look no further than Goldsmiths University in London, whose LGBTQ group have issued a threat to the TERFs, the women who don't accept transgender. They've said that these women are responsible literally for killing people, which I suspect is not literally true. But then their use of words is extremely confused, because they also say they threaten that they should be sent for re-education in the gulag. And when this was pointed out that this was rather a bad idea and an awful threat, because the gulags, the Russian gulags, weren't exactly great places, they said, well, no. The gulags were really compassionate. Now, this really is just unbelievable. You should, we put a link to the article. So have a look at the article and you just think, no. You can't get any madder. Apparently, the gulag is for re-education and it's a compassionate, non-violent course of action. It was a rehabilitatory system. There were regular classes and book clubs and newspaper editorial teams and sports theatre and performance groups. Now, believe it or not, at various times I've been threatened with re-education. And in fact, this really is what happens if you speak out of turn in a company or a firm, if you don't go along with the particular values, say, well, you need diversity and equality training. It's re-education. Our children at the moment are being schooled in particular worldviews, and I guess if they step out of line, they'll be sent for further re-education. But this goes one step further. The gulag. It really is quite extraordinary. If you want to know what the gulags are right, read Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago. I can never pronounce that. Maybe I should be sent for re-education in spelling and pronouncing. Unbelievable. Let's turn now to the Archbishop of Canterbury, who in a barnstorming address, I think you could call that, to the Trade Union Congress, has come up with some very, very interesting statements. The address is well worth listening to. And unlike some of my colleagues in the ministry and in the church, I don't think it's, in one sense, a bad or disastrous address. Nor do I think, by the way, as others do, that it's a prophetic message. There are many things within it that are right. There are many challenges that are right. But it's what he leaves out that's an enormous problem. The Archbishop, of course, spoke in terms that the trade unions absolutely loved, giving the impression that Jesus was a socialist and that God was a socialist and God would have been on their side.
500 years later, near Nazareth, a young pregnant woman called Mary went to see her cousin Elizabeth. Mary, greeted by Elizabeth as the mother of the Saviour Jesus, cried out in what we know as the Magnificat, saying about God, "He has shown strength with his arm. He has scattered the proud in the thoughts of their hearts. He has brought down the powerful from their thrones and lifted up the lowly. He has filled the hungry with good things, and the rich he has sent away empty."
taking passages from Amos, from the Gospels, and elsewhere to comment on current political issues such as universal credit and the big companies.
If you earn money from a community, you should pay your share of tax to that community.
Now, what's the problem? As I said, there are many things in it, I think, well, fair enough. But here's the problem.
I was in business, and I know that within limits, it is right and proper for people to arrange their tax affairs and for companies to do so. But when vast companies like Amazon and other online traders, the new industries, can get away with paying almost nothing in tax, there is something wrong with the tax system.
First of all, hypocrisy. Because today we have discovered that whilst the Archbishop stuck the boot into Amazon, the Church of England is one of the biggest investors in Amazon. And they have no intention of removing that investment. So the Archbishop attacks Amazon for being unjust and says that God is not on their side, but the Church of England is. It is. The whiff of hypocrisy just goes through it all. Secondly, it's what he doesn't say. So, for example, in Mary's song.
Mary's song is revolution in immortal verse. Mary's song, the Magnificat, central to the New Testament, is so revolutionary that anyone who takes it seriously finds it a threat to power and entitlement.
He says it's a song about revolution. Yes, but it is a revolution. It's a revolution about a world that cannot be saved by politics, that cannot be saved by people imitating God, which is what his message seemed to be, but can only be saved by Jesus and his atoning work on the cross. Mary had a baby, and her baby was born to die for the sins of the world. And that just doesn't get mentioned at all. Sins don't get mentioned in that article, in that speech, I think, except perhaps the sins of the rich. And again, there's just a little tad of hypocrisy. He talks about the threat to power and entitlement. Well, the Archbishop of Canterbury himself has a lot of power and a lot of entitlement. If he wants to get away from that, then perhaps they should de-invest in Amazon, but also the bishop should withdraw from the House of Lords. But I think my biggest problem is the way that, although it is a very, in some ways it's a very good speech, I really do want to say that, it's articulate, it's well put together, and it's well argued. Again, it's what's missing. So let's take Amos.
Let justice roll down like waters, and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream.
A verse that I used to have on my wall when I was very involved in student politics many years ago. Let justice roll on like a river, righteousness like a never-failing stream. Yeah. But what is justice and what is righteousness? Because if you read the rest of that book, you will find that there is an attack on the Israelites for ripping apart pregnant women. So does the Archbishop say anything about abortion and the injustice of abortion? Not a word. Not a word. A true prophet would challenge the nation at its idols, not reaffirm them in terms of its idols. And what about in Amos, the biggest problem that God has? The problem is that they have forsaken him, and they are called to seek the Lord and live. In fact, they are told that their religious festivals are detestable to him. The Archbishop says that he's concerned along with other religious leaders. But what does the Bible have to say about false religion? A great deal more than it has to say about atheism. But the Archbishop is completely silent. Do you know, I think this speech could have been given without any reference. In fact, there was very little reference, really, to Jesus. To me, there's just so much that is missing in it. It's a good political speech. It's an awful prophetic speech. Meanwhile, another conference was ongoing. one I would have loved to have been at, Keith Getty's Sing Conference in Nashville, at which 7,500 pastors and worship leaders were there learning how to sing psalms, actually. That was the theme for this year. I really enjoyed listening to as much of it as I could online, and I would recommend that you do so as well. But the psalms, they really, 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 they cut across absolutely everything here: what humanity is, how we treat one another, who God is, what justice is, and particularly this version of Psalm 130. Listen to this, and then we'll finish with just a book recommendation and our quote of the day.
Out of the depths I cry to you, in darkest places I will call. Incline your ear to me anew, and hear my cry for mercy, Lord. Were you to count my sinful ways, how could I come before your throne? Yet full forgiveness meets my gaze. I stand redeemed by grace alone. I will wait for you, I will wait for you on your word. I will rely, I will wait for you, surely wait for you, till my soul is satisfied.
Book recommendation is just a brilliant book. Gay Girl, Good God, which I'm writing a review of right now, by Jackie Hill Perry. Best way to describe it is the book that Vicky Beeching should have written. It is the antidote to her nonsense. I see again that Vicky is still going around all the studios. I guess Jackie Hill Perry won't be invited to any studios, but an absolutely wonderful book, beautifully written, Christ-centered. And let me just give you one quote to finish with. She says this, is from her book, obviously. I don't believe it is wise or truthful to the power of the gospel to identify oneself by the sins of one's past or the temptations of one's present, but rather to only be defined by the Christ who's overcome both for those he calls his own. All men and women, including myself, that are well acquainted with sexual temptation are ultimately not what our temptation says of us. We are what Christ had done for us. Therefore, our ultimate identity is very simple. We are Christians. Amen. See you next week. Yo.
We're part of a culture that really loves to hate us. Every chance they get, they attempt to isolate and debate us. It's not that they don't like us, it's just they don't like God in us. It's common knowledge, and oddly enough, it makes a lot of sense to a lot of us. We completely understand because we used to occupy the same space and lived in a similar type state until we tasted of God's grace. So we continue loving this world that so easily rejects us and passionately press past the lack of their cultural acceptance. And as if there weren't enough problems for us gaining influence, we keep fighting over the issue of what's too worldly of a Christian to make a difference. So no matter how you paint it or politically campaign it, whether you water it down and drain it, it's really all the same, ain't it? It's the same frustration, same constant segregation. Christians living like aliens trying to relate with citizens of a different nation. What always makes for a better presentation than bark and bite is a proper understanding of living life filled with salt and light. So we walk this fine line of walking in light of God's kindness and live with a sense of worldliness without the fear of compromising. Loving God and neighbor until Christ comes to split the sky or die in a society hailing Jesus as Messiah. Yep.